screen today, we have the title of the message, and now I'm sort of feeling a little more in sync today. We have the title of the message, and the title of the message is "The Bad News, the Bad and the Good News About the Distant Country." Now, this is part one, and today we're going to start off by talking about some beginnings. And you'll notice underneath that we have the aha experience. So I want to try to explain these. Now, our passage, our text is going to be Luke, the 15th chapter, verses 11 through 31. Some of you may recognize that as the story of the prodigal son. Now, I'm sure we've all heard this expression. If not, you're going to hear it maybe for the first time today, but here's the expression. They had a come to Jesus meeting. Now, have you ever heard that expression? Yeah, we've all heard that. And what that phrase is trying to express is this magical moment where you finally understand your circumstances. You get a hold of reality. You look around, you say, you know what, man, it's either really good or it's really, really, really bad. And it's amazing because man has thought about that quite a bit through the course of history. John Haywood in 1546, he borrowed something from the Bible, Jeremiah, I think around verse chapter 35, verse 4, somewhere thereabouts. But he took that thought that Jeremiah had expounded about the nation of Israel, and he encapsulated that thought into this. And I'm sure you've heard this phrase as well. There are none so blind as those who will not see. Now, what he was saying is that the most deluded people are those who choose to ignore what they already know. Now, we can define and distill all those kind of things down just to really one thought that we have in our repertoire of words. And it's aha. Everyone say aha. Aha. Now, what that word is really expressing is expressing the sudden understanding. It's a moment that comes to us. It's recognition. It turns into resolve after recognition. And as a Christian over the years, and I've been a Christian since I've been 10 years of age, I've been blessed to have those moments in my life where I've looked around at my circumstances and I said, aha. And here's what I know. I've been blessed to share with others who have had those magical moments when God finally did something amazing. He got their attention. And it's already usually something that you already know. It's something that is around you, something that you learned when you were a youth, something that you were taught and discipled through, but you just never really acted out on it. But it comes to you. It's an intrinsic thing almost. And what I know about all those stories is this. Every one of them is different. How God gets our attention is vastly different. But they're also vastly the same. See, the circumstances can be different, but I want you to understand that there's always three ingredients, regardless of the circumstances, if you're going to have that moment where you truly come to yourself. And so in your notes today, in your outline, you can write these three things down. Now, let me preface this by saying, this is not being given to you that you might fix somebody. Because we'll never fix anybody. You know, the old proverb about if you're on the airplane, they tell you, you know, you got to put the mask on your face first before you can attempt to put it on your child. Friends, I want you to understand, this is about fixing ourselves today. Because I think we're broken in ways we fail to realize. Now, here they are. Sudden awakening. What do we mean by that? Just, you look around, you say, hey, I'm not in such a good place. Second thing, brutal honesty. It takes that to have that aha moment in the distant country. And the third thing is immediate action. Have you studied the scriptures? You see this. It's really clear. There are those three things that always are in the defining moments of people's life when they turn things around. Always. Until those three elements happen, they don't. And one of the best known of all of those stories is the prodigal son, the parable of the prodigal son. And as I mentioned to our praise team this morning, our worship leaders this morning, it's not an actual story. But that does not mean that it's a story that's not full of life. And most of us are familiar with the story. And I'm making it my goal that everyone that comes to this message series, while these messages will be standalone messages, I think it's vitally important that you come to all five of them and hear the progression through the story. And I believe that we all can come away with some real moments that we can say, you know, aha, that's what God meant. Aha, that's where I've come from. So over the next several weeks, we're going to look at what it means to be in the distant country. We're going to talk about what the bad news is in the distant country. But we're also going to realize that there's some great news that can be found in the distant country. So we're going to start at the beginnings. Before you can have that come to Jesus meeting, that come to Jesus moment, you got to figure out the beginning. Every story has a beginning. There's an old phrase. Most of us are familiar with it. I don't know. Somebody just give me the movie Frozen to watch. I think it was the Lukens that gave that to me to watch. That's part of my training here as a pastor. I had to watch the movie Frozen. My daughter has a very warped sense of humor. And she sent me a text yesterday with the, I guess, the Frozen princess, the girl that could make things freeze. She was on this little thing, and behind it, the church, it was a church cancellation. And I should have sent it to Brian to put it on the screen. But if you want to see it, you can see it on my phone after service. It's pretty funny. See, every story begins once upon a time, doesn't it? Now, can you just imagine something without a beginning? We can't. There has to be beginning. I tell you, beginnings are important because they ultimately can tell you where the story is going to go to. You have to have a starting point. So let me just stress the beginnings this morning again by this. If I were going to say, I'm going to say a couple things, and I want to see if you can guess the beginning. Now here's the first one. A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Star Wars, yeah. For those of us who read, which I hope is all of us, it was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Tale of Two Cities, Charles Dickens. That's right. Very great book, isn't it? Yeah. Here's another one. We'll see how spiritual you are this morning. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. What? John 1:1, that's right. So we can understand that beginnings are foundational. Whether we're talking about the prodigal that we love and we care for and we want to see come back to the Father's house, or we're considering ourselves. They set the stage by telling us what life was like at the beginning of the story. Before the story even takes off, it lets us know what's going on. And the beginning, again, I will say, can tell us a lot about the way the story will end. But here's what happens. Once we start talking about the aha moments, how someone changed, how they had that moment in life in the distant country and they start their journey home, we forget how the story begins. And the story can become so defined by what has drastically changed, and we get lost in the sauce and we forget about how the story actually started. And that's why beginnings are so important. They set the stage for the rest of the story. Now, here's a fact. If you're in a counseling session, or if you're ever going to go to a counseling session, they just don't want to hear where you're at right now. They want to hear the beginning of the story. They want to hear the circumstances that got you to where you're at. So right now, think about it this way. If we're going to tell a rags-to-riches story, it's important that we realize what the rags really were. And in this story, it's interesting because it's not a rags to riches story. It's a riches to rags, then back to riches story. So the beginning really tells us what the life is like, what the person's life is like before this story, and why the story sort of makes sense because there's appropriate actions that are being taken place. So with that in mind, let's look at verses just 11 and 12 today. Not a lot of scripture here, but there's a lot being said in these two verses here. Here, let's read. Then he said, a certain man had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of goods that falls to me. So he divided them his livelihood. Now may God bless the reading, the hearing, and the preaching of his word today. So let's talk about the beginning. The story starts out as a family. Most of us can identify with that. It begins at home. And here's a father who has two sons. They're at home together. They live together. They work together. Because that's exactly what families did in the time of this story. The father obviously is not poor. He had enough wealth that the son, the younger of the sons, obviously wanted the wealth. They have a pretty good life because if we read the end of the story, we realize that the father has servants and livestock. So he is well-to-do. And we can glean from the type of possessions that are mentioned here that there was work involved in those possessions. Livestock, servants, those kind of things require perpetual work. It's just not like putting an investment in an account somewhere with Merrill Lynch and then expecting a return off of it. You had to get in there and work that livestock. You had to work with the servants. So the bottom line, it wasn't like this kid was wealthy and his family was wealthy because of hitting the lottery. There was work involved. And home, really, in actuality, for this kid, for both kids for that matter, it's a pretty good place to be. Just had one problem. Required constant work. Wasn't just a handover kind of thing. But there's something in this younger son. Just fires off. He wants to leave home. No matter how good it is, no matter how well he is provided for, no matter how much his family loves him, there is something firing off inside him that he wants to leave. So let me point this out to some parents here today of prodigals. We've all been the prodigal in some way in our life. And the problem really isn't in the parenting. It's in the inherent rebellious nature that is in every one of us. In many ways, we all rebel in some way. Think about this. When the son goes to his dad and he says, "Dad, I want my share of the inheritance." This is effectively what this kid is saying. "Dad, I wish you were dead." Let's freeze for a moment. Have you ever heard that maybe from your child? Have you ever thought that about your parents? Life would be better if I just had what they had and they were out of the picture. See, when this kid said, "Listen, I want everything that you've got coming to me," he was saying, "Dad, I wish you were dead." And dad just didn't have a checking account. He didn't have stock certificates. He didn't have slush fund somewhere where he could just write something out and say, "Here you go, kid, here you go." He had hard assets. He had things like grain and livestock and wine and clothing and all these things had to be sold to give this kid money. So he just couldn't write a check over. He had to open up the community to seeing the turmoil that was going on in his house. It was sort of like an estate sale that we will see from time to time. And what this kid was doing wouldn't go over very well in that community. And would it go well today? Anytime we see a child that we feel that just sort of camped out for his parents' money, we don't really think well of that child. And imagine saying something like this in a culture that is vastly, in many ways, different than our culture today. Because the father legally had the right to slap his son if he came to him with such a request. The son is obviously immoral. He's obviously rude. He's obviously selfish. And all those things started off with him becoming obsessed by doing what he wants and when he wants to do it. And he treats his father in such a way that is so disrespectful. It's just unbelievable. in any culture that we would talk about. Now, in my research, I came across Dr. Kenneth Bailey, who lived and taught in Middle Eastern studies in the Middle East for 40 years. Very intelligent man, a great biblical scholar. In his study of the prodigal son, here's what he had to say about the story. He has never found an example in the past or present of a son requesting and receiving inheritance to his father's riches prior to the father's death. Now, you understand what he's saying there. He's never come across an example where a father gave to a child what the kid asked. Not saying it didn't happen. He's just saying it never happened where a dad would give the money to the kid. For Middle Easterners, that son's actions were communicated to his father just simply said that he wished his dad was dead, which I've already said. In response to such a request, a Middle Eastern father would just slap the kid, run him out of the house. And the people listening to what Christ was saying there that day understood that that's what would happen. He would get an open backhand across the face. Yet in this parable, Christ does something amazing. He tells us that the father unexpectedly grants his son's request. The text says that he divided his living. And Bailey points out this, that the word living there comes the Greek word bios, and it means literally physical life. This is how the man sustained himself. He took all his possessions. He took everything that was that kept his household flowing, that kept things coming in, things going out. He took all those things and just divided them. Really, the text could read this way, and he divided his life between his two sons. That accurately depicts the depth of what's going on here. Now, Dr. Bailey continues by saying this. In his research, he had, however, come across two instances where sons went to their dads and said, "Hey, Dad, give me what's mine." In one instance, the father chased the kid out of the house, run him right out of the house. Now, what would you do if your kid came to you and said, "Hey, give me what's coming to me"? I'd be calling up the lawyer and I'd be changing the will. And he'd see exactly what would be coming, or she for that matter, to them. The other instance, the second father, who was previously healthy, this is very sad, died 3 months later. And they attribute it to the son coming and breaking his heart. So Jesus gives this story where the request is made, it's granted, and basically it's just really unheard of by anyone listening. Now, maybe in this young man's mind, and we're being hypothetical here, but we can use our sanctified imagination. Maybe he starts off thinking that, you know what, this isn't so bad. I'm sure he legitimized it some way. He says, well, to himself, it might sound a little selfish, but you know what? Dad's going to give it to me anyway, and I'm within my rights. Again, let me remind you, there are none so blind as those who will not see. He probably didn't intend to break his father's heart. He probably did some mental exercises and said, okay, I can make it okay. My dad will be fine with it. He probably never meant to destroy the relationship between his father and him, his brother as well, with his whole family to be exact. So what started out with being a little selfish ambition, maybe on his part, had rolled into this big, nasty mess. But all he knew that he did not want someone looking over his shoulder, and he never really could count the cost of what the cost would be for leaving home. Now, it's easy for us to take a high attitude about this. On this side of the story, we think this younger kid, man, he's crazy. Why would you want to leave home? Why would you get out? He's lost his mind. He's at the least very uncaring. He's stupid, to be frank about it. And to pretend that we don't feel that way is just silly on our part. But my guess, if we're really honest, we'd have to admit in ways we've left home too. Now, I'm not talking about in a healthy way. It's a healthy thing to move out, to get on your own. What I am talking about is leaving God's house. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Because I hope we realize that in this story, it's a metaphor for the Father who is in heaven. Let's be clear about it. We walk away from where God is. That's exactly what this young man was doing, and it is exactly what we do in varying degrees in our life. Because you know, the further in the story was more than just this fictional dad. In this parable, the young son is leaving the Father's house in heaven. He's leaving God in the dust. So, in many ways, in some ways in our life, we leave God in the dust. What makes us want to live a life that's apart from God? Rebellion? Or what drives us to leave a good father's house who has always provided for us, who would do anything for us, even the things that we don't really think we need, he still will do for us. I would imagine that with any of us this morning, when we left the Father's house, it probably started out just a little selfishly. I don't need church. I don't need to hear the message. I don't need to hear Sunday school. I don't need to do any of those things. You know, I have friends who don't go to church and they're driving luxury cars. I don't need to tithe. You know, those kind of things. And what starts out with a little selfish ambition has ultimately led us to a place where we're really not all that close to God. We don't want anyone looking over our shoulders. And we never really counted the cost of what it really would cost. We know God cares for us. We know that God provides for us. We know that God saved us from sin. Home is good. But there's something in us that we're like this moth that's drawn to a flame. We continue to get burned and burned. We're drawn toward a different light. We can't resist. And we within inside ourselves, we're just urged to ask for our inheritance. And then we take it and go. If we know home's so good, why does anyone leave home in the first place? It's just something that goes on inside of us. It's not right. And we need to combat it. We need to fight it. In the story, I think there are three elements that we can unpackage that why this kid in this parable wanted to leave the Father's house. Ultimately, we understand it's why he wanted to leave God's house. And so I want us to look at those because it's the same thing that happens to us. And as I said, starting out in this message today, this isn't about us fixing anybody else. This is about us fixing ourselves. And the first one is this. I want it now. Now, what do we mean by that? Instant gratification. Simply, we cannot wait. I was at the doctor's office for a little thing last week, and I got the customer survey over the phone, and one of the first questions, in fact, the very first question, how was the waiting time in the office? Well, it was pretty good. I read a Car and Driver magazine, so it was pretty good for me. We just don't like to wait. We will rush to an intersection, break a law or two, just to avoid waiting at a red light. Here's our mindset. We want it fixed now, right? We want it fixed now. We want our meal now. We go to the restaurant, and someone's waiting on us. And we get accustomed to a certain wait time. The other day I was at Bravo's. Brenda and I were having dinner there. And the wait time was a little more than I was used to. Now, I did not say anything about it other than to her. I said, wow, they seem a little slow today. Which they were. We just don't want to wait. We don't want to wait for our money. We don't want to save incrementally to try to establish a pattern, a 401k, a 403, whatever the case may be, an IRA account, Roth, whatever it may be. We don't want to invest incrementally in the church over the period of years and years and see how God can use that. We just want it now. One of the reasons we leave the Father's house is that it's just this idea of instant gratification. We're not going to wait in anything in life at all, regardless of what it is. So let's take it to a deeper level. What are we talking about? Teenagers and their love life. I mean, sex is a wonderful thing. It's a beautiful thing. But God has ordained it to be within the confines of marriage. Get out of that, you've left the Father's house, friend. And don't take that as someone taking a high and mighty attitude toward you. I understand things happen. I certainly understand that things happen. Let's take it a little deeper with our finances. We leverage ourselves so poorly that we can't do the things that need to be done. We're not saving for a rainy day. We're not saving for any kind of retirement or anything of that nature. And we're certainly not contributing to the work of God. Why? Because you want something now that you probably don't need. You've left the Father's house. We're just really not good at waiting. We're so used to instant messaging. We're in the instant downloads. I mean, Cincinnati Bell has now this unbelievable package that you can buy to do the internet on where it is zap, it's right there. In fact, you have to have this extremely expensive computer to be able to utilize it. It's that fast. We've got instant popcorn, which I particularly do not care for. We've got instant soup. I get mad at my car, at the GPS. When I turn the car on, and it takes a little time for the gerbils to wake up inside there and start spinning their wheels, get going. I put an address in, it's got to think about it. Well, we might go this way, we might go that way. We want an instant, don't we? And as Christians, let's just take it down to the level that it needs to be. A lot of the Christian life, living in the Father's house, is about waiting. It's based on delayed gratification. We don't have heaven before us right now. It is before us, but we're certainly not in heaven right now. We live our life waiting on God's return. We live our life waiting on the ultimate sanctification and justification of ourselves. We're saved. We're still in the fallen world. So we just simply wait. We're sure of heaven, but we're not there yet. So we wait. You know, Matt, if you weren't here a couple weeks ago when Matt brought a wonderful message from Romans 8:28, the verse says this, "And we know all things work to good, for the good, for them to love God and called according to his purpose." We confuse what good is. It's his good. It's his purpose. If you weren't here, see Brian about getting a copy of that. Go to the website. You can download it. One of the best messages probably been ever preached out of this pulpit, bar none. We're not just, we confuse what good is. We have a charismatic, name it and claim it mindset that thinks, well, when we read that verse, God means it to good. And we define good by our good. No, good is defined by what he says is good. So we confuse our wants and desires, and we wind up not being happy because we think our wants and desires are the good. No, that's not the good. And so when the right thing doesn't happen, according to us, we get all honked off at God. We get angry with God, and we don't want to wait. Waiting on God's purpose, Let me give you something that's going to save you a lot of time, trouble, and anguish in life. Waiting on God's purpose will save you from many a mistake in life. It will save you from many a sorrow. But sometimes we just can't wait. Even though we realize that Isaiah, the Shakespeare of the Old Testament, cried out these words, "Those who wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles." After waiting for a while, we get sick and think of it this way. "I'm tired of waiting. I'm not waiting. I want it now." So we leave. As a young adult, we make the choice not to wait on marriage to have sex. As a consumer, instead of saving up and doing the right thing over the course of time, you make a decision to spend money that you're probably never going to ever have. It causes a lot of anguish. And we're in the pig pen, and we don't even want to admit it. Let me give you the second one. I spent a little time on that, but I think it was worth it. I deserve it. I'm entitled to it. It's simply entitlement. Another reason we leave the Father's house is just this dangerous mentality. I think it's militant in many ways of entitlement. It's an attitude that says, "I deserve it." It's an attitude that says, "I have every right to be happy. I have every right to expect that everything's going to go my way." What is it, the old song? "Oh, what a beautiful feeling," or what a beautiful day. "I've got a wonderful feeling, everything's going my way." No, it's not going to go your way, my friend. "I've been faithful long enough. I deserve a break." Maybe this kid in his father's house, he thought about, "You know what, I've been here. I've been taking care of the sheep. I've been watching the camels. I've been making sure the servants are all lined up. You know what, I need a break. I need to get away from it all. And in fact, I really don't want to do this stuff anymore. I've been good long enough, and I deserve to have some real fun. I've been patient long enough. Now I deserve some fulfillment. I've been doing it God's way long enough. Now I deserve to do something the way that I want to do it." Simply, it can be defined as selfishness. Charles Finney writes about selfishness, and here's what he says. He says, "Selfishness is the phenomenon of the will and consists in committing the will to the gratifications of our desire. When we submit our will to the gratification of our desires, it's all over, friend. I'm going to fulfill what I want, my desires, above what's right, above what's good, above what's going to be consistent with God's word." And it matters not to us who we're going to hurt. So let's distill that down. You want what you want. And with this story, let me jump a little bit ahead. When this kid got what he wanted, he found out he didn't really want what he got. You know what happens to us? We begin to be in church, and then we're out of church because it doesn't line up with our selfish desires. I mean, do you ever feel like that? Just be honest and open this morning. If God's not plugging it in the way you think he ought to plug it in, you're not going to be here. It's like a never-ending loop, like on your iPod. You play the same song over and over again. The scenery never changes. It's Groundhog Day all over again. The same perpetual thing in and out. And you never really want to admit it's this sense of entitlement that's inside me. See, with this mentality, we forget the core aspect of living the Christian life. There's not one of us here deserve anything. We were saved by God's grace. By the way, you didn't deserve that. You made an open response to God's grace. God saved you by your response to his grace. We don't deserve any of the good things that God's given us. We learned in the stewardship series, if we have anything above zero, we have more than what we started with. We don't deserve any of the good things we have. Whether I'm talking about your marriage, talking about your children, talking about your job. But God offers them to us freely. He offers them to us in love towards us. And we begin to think, you know what? I deserve this. I have the right to this. I've earned the right to do something stupid. For men, and pastors can be very guilty of this. For men, there are men that literally think that pastor a church, that they do so much good, it's okay for them to have an affair. Now, I'm saying that from the circles I travel in, the things that I read about. But I know this to be true. There's members that think they probably do enough good within the church to think it's okay to have a little liaisons, a little affair. There's probably some students here today that think, you know what, I go to church. I'm active. I do some things here. It's okay for me to meet a need in my house, in my life, I should say, in a very illegitimate way. What does that equal out to? Well, it equals out in not having sex in the way God intended it to be done. Again, let me say, God is not against sex. He's all for it. He made male and female. He designed us in such a way that there's a lot of great things from it. Wonderful, pleasurable things. Things that even the book of Hebrews tells us that the marriage bed's undefiled before the eyes of God. But when we leave the Father's house, we leave to fulfill that need, that desire, in a very illegitimate way. Entitlement. Let me tell you something. I don't care what you name. You don't deserve it. I want you to understand that. Whatever you name in your life that you have right now, this may not win me many popularity contests, but it's the truth. You don't deserve it. Now here's the third thing. I can do better on my own. Resentment. Now the third common attitude that we see in the story and in ourselves as well that makes us want to leave the Father's house is this attitude of resentment that just says, I can do it better on my own. You really get this idea from the younger son. It's not that his father hadn't provided for him. The kid had a lot going for him, didn't he? Can I tell you something? Right now in God's kingdom, in God's house, if you have truly trusted the Lord Jesus Christ, born again, you've got a lot going for you. You really do. You've got, in fact, a lot, everything going for you. But we get in our heads, just like this young man did in his head, I can do it better on my own. You get this idea from the younger son. The father did provide for him, but he's saying, hey, Dad, let's divvy up the estate. Let's tee it up. I'm ready to head out of here. You get the sense that the son just wanted to do some things on his own. He wanted to try his own hand to be his own master. He wanted to lead his own life. In some ways, as I thought about this third attitude, it's really a combination. It's a compilation of the first two. You see, you want something now, and you feel like you've earned it, so you're tired of waiting, and you just forget about God, and you do it your own way. It's a danger for Saul, King Saul. It's a danger for every one of us. And with this attitude, we forget that the Christian life, living a life in the Father's house, is all about simply being a slave. I want us all to say this morning, I'm a slave. Let's say it on three. One, two, three. I'm a slave. That's our identity. And we resent that? We really shouldn't. The Apostle Paul used that language very, very much in his works. He says that he was a bondservant of Christ. And as a slave, you resign all rights, all claims, all power to any decision making. We, as slaves of God, have not made a commitment. We have surrendered to him. We don't get to call the shots. He does. He's the king. But here's one of the most fascinating things about God. Just like the father in the story, he lets us make those statements. This is the part that's so hard for sometimes for us to get a hold of. He lets us make those statements. He lets us walk away. Here's what we do. Instead of trying to allow the prodigal to work some things out in their life, we try to play sovereign over their life. And we think that we're going to fix them. Here's what I know. This is Brenda and my testimony to every one of you here today. The hardest thing that you will ever do is allow the prodigal to walk out of your life. Do you think it was easy for this father to allow his kid to walk out of his life? I mean, didn't he have enough money, enough possessions that said he could have said, you know what? I'm going to fix it so you can't go. I'm going to tie you down. I'm going to strap you down here. You're not going to leave. No, he didn't do that. And let me say this. God in his love toward us has never done that with any one of us. He allows us to do the incredulous things. He allows us to say the petty things that will cost us so much in the end. So let me challenge you, mom, dad, grandparent. If you want to be more like God, here's what you got to do. You got to let go. That means they might go out and crash and burn. That means they might go out into the pig pen and suffer great catastrophic loss. What it might mean is that they may come home with an illness that is incurable. But God loves us enough, and we're going to see in this series, that he designed consequences in our actions. And we need to understand that. So if you want to be more like God, just let go. Because that's what he's done with you, in the hopes that you might freely choose to return to him. A lot of us at one time or the other, maybe right now, maybe we've made statements like, you know what, I'm sick of being in the Father's house, and we've walked away. It can start with just a little request, a little control, a little harmless pleasure. And we're not trying to tell God that he's not first place in our life, but then again, we want to try to make him a very close second in our life. We're not trying to tell God that he's wrong about marriage, but we're saying, you know what? I've got a better way, God, than marriage. I deserve to be happy. We're not trying to tell God that we don't want nothing to do with him, but it's just silly for us to give to the church on a regular, continual tithing basis. You may not intend, God, that you wish that he was dead, but that's exactly what you're saying when you say these type of things. It's a dangerous attitude. And I think it, as I said earlier, it comes from the name and claim it crowd. We expect to be healed now, yet we don't want to do the background work to lead to a healthy lifestyle. We expect to have all the finances that we could ever dreamed of. So we'll pray and we'll throw a lot of money over here and there in the plate, and we think that God's going to double it and triple it. Doesn't happen that way. If it was like that, why would we ever have to die? Why would we ever have to go to heaven? To me, those things are so much like the prodigal. Now, here's the truth. We've all left the Father's house at one time or the other. And it's not so much a question of whether or not you've left. It's really a question to the excuse that you have used to leave and to what degree that you have left. It's much more a question of, are you willing to come back now? Are you ready to have that sudden awakening? See, the story could end here, and it doesn't. I'm so grateful. We're going to talk about some things over the next 4 weeks I think are vitally important. What it takes for us to come back. What it takes for us to have that moment in the distant country where we finally realize God still loves us and things are so much better in His house. So the bad news about the distant country, it will take everything that you have in some way, shape, or form. But the good news is this. You can come home. It's time to come home. Would you all stand with me this morning? Would you bow with me in prayer, please? Father, forgive us for leaving Your house. We ask these things in Christ's name, amen. So we begin to play songs.